Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
It's written apparently for young adults. It's by Scholastic, my young adult publisher. Whenever I do a book for adults, like Manhunt, my book about the chase for John Wilkes Booth, I've done a young adult book also. And by young adult, I mean older teens. This is the first time I've done a book just for teens, but also it's for adults too. I don't think of writing down or dumbing down for kids. It's a shorter book. Maybe it's a few hundred pages. It's illustrated. But adults tell me they find it as interesting as any other book on Martin Luther King. So I'm really writing for a dual audience.
I suppose the sentences get a little shorter. I don't think putting a lot of pictures in there hurts the book at all. Mm-hmm. As an adult, I found those helpful and fascinating. I hadn't seen all of those.
Some of them are unknown. I really worked hard to find interesting photographs that people might not have seen before. And also, we constructed very elaborate diagrams to show exactly what happened.
This, on the 50-year anniversary of Martin Luther King's passing, we all spent so much time on that last week. You chose to focus on chasing King's killer. Why that angle of the story?
Well, that's a point of entry to the story. The book is not just about the death of Martin Luther King, or his last week, his last few days, or his last day. It's about a tragic death, but it's also about a great and heroic life. So it's really about King's entire life and his last year and the changes he is experiencing. And it's really a dual story that begins in early 1967. Who is Martin Luther King then? He's suffering a lot of doubt. People in the movement are challenging him. He opposes the Vietnam War, and his former great ally in the civil rights movement, President Johnson, turns against him, and he's racked by doubt. At the same time, James LeRae, a nobody criminal, a lifelong loser, who spent a third of his life in prison for petty crimes, armed robberies, burglaries, escapes from prison, and he's on the run for a year. So I track what King is doing and what Ray is doing, because Ray seems to be on a journey to 1960s America. He goes to California. He takes self-hypnosis lessons. He takes dancing lessons.
Ballroom dancer.
Bartending school.
Yeah.
And the last thing he's doing is hunting down Martin Luther King. He wants to reinvent himself, like hundreds of thousands of lost souls in the 1960s. He travels and then heads to California.
Well, does he see himself as a sort of savior of white supremacy? I mean, reinvent yourself, yeah, but why as the killer of Martin Luther King?
Well, we don't know exactly why to this day, because growing up as a young man, he was not racially violent. He wasn't part of the Klan. He didn't protest. He didn't participate in racial violence. He volunteered for the George Wallace presidential campaign in California, and there was an odd lot out there, and he hung out with them. But he was living the nightlife of a barfly and a solitary man with no real connections. And then all of a sudden, in March 1968, Martin Luther King goes to California, to Los Angeles, speaks in Anaheim, gives a sermon in a church. James LeRae doesn't attend. But the day King leaves town, Ray gets in his Mustang and drives all the way across America to Georgia and then to Tennessee. And 3 weeks later, King is dead. And Ray never told us why. I have some theories about why, but we don't know because he wouldn't tell us.
What do you think?
I think he wanted to achieve some kind of significance in life. He realized his life was empty. It had no meaning. He wanted to do something to be remembered. When he escaped from prison for his petty crimes, he fantasized that he'd be in the FBI most wanted list. After he killed Martin Luther King, he went to a bar to watch television and asked them to turn on that old show, The FBI, with Ephraim Zimbalist, because at the end of each of those shows, they would name the most wanted man in America. And he loved watching himself on television. It gave him meaning, and Martin Luther King was the means through which this was done.
Up to that point, though, well, he was a career criminal and an escaped criminal. The most there was ever a warrant for his arrest was $50.
Yes.
It was the highest bounty he'd ever achieved.
Yes.
So he was really small potatoes. He was not on the radar of anybody.
No.
As he was intersecting with Martin Luther King Jr.
No, he was not. And there was also a theory that anonymous white men had offered a $50,000 or $100,000 reward for the man who would kill King. But if that was even true, how would Ray have collected that reward? He was on the run. He was fleeing the country. He fled to Canada. Then he fled to England. He could have never enforced that promise. Also, There's a question of, did he act alone? Later, after he pled guilty and tried to get out of that plea, he claimed that a mysterious co-conspirator named Raoul had directed all his movements. All the evidence proves that it was James Earl Ray who shot Martin Luther King and did it alone. But I do think one or two of his brothers helped him along the way during his escape.
He had, what, 8 siblings, right?
Yes.
His father was a criminal, too.
Yes, his uncle was a criminal. One of his brothers was a criminal. His father was a criminal. He came from a Missouri, Southern Illinois criminal family that was as poor as that family was during the Civil War. They had nothing.
I want to talk about the hunt for him after the assassination, but just a couple of revelations that took place leading up to this. You open the book with the scene where Martin Luther King is stabbed in the chest by a distraught woman, a crazy woman with a letter opener. I did not know that story. Shame on me.
Well, it was 1958 in New York. King had achieved some fame as a leader of the Montgomery, Alabama bus strike. And he got on the cover of Time magazine, and he decided to write his first book. He went to New York City, to Harlem, for a book signing, and went to Bloomstein's department store in September 58. The night before, at one of his rallies, a very attractive, well-dressed black woman was heckling him. And then the next day, she showed up at the book signing. No one realized it was the woman from the night before. And she said, "Are you Martin Luther King?" And he said, "Yes, I am." And she said, "I've been after you for 5 years. You've ruined my life." And she reached in her purse. It's a good thing she didn't reach for her bra, because she was hiding a pistol in her bra. And said she reached for a razor-sharp Japanese letter opener. It was really like a miniature samurai sword, 6 or 8 inches long, like an ice pick. She raised her arm, and she stabbed him in the heart before he could stop her. And he was rushed to the hospital, and he almost died. If he had moved a little, it would have cut his aorta. But he was spared. He was saved. Surgery was performed. And that gave him the choice of deciding what kind of life did he want to have. Did he want to go back south and live the life that his father had lived, a prominent minister, leader in the community? Or did he want to become a leader and follow his destiny? So that put him on a 10-year arc that led him to Memphis. He sat later. He said, "Well, we must all be prepared to die." And then the scar over his heart healed in the form of a cross. And he joked, and he said, that's an appropriate scar for a minister of the gospel.
You know, so many of us were transfixed last week when we were playing back the audio of his mountaintop speech to the sanitation workers. And he spoke sort of apocalyptically, didn't he, about maybe his passing and,
yes,
and so forth. And I didn't exactly know where that came from, except that he must have known that what he was doing was a dangerous path where he was going. But evidently, he'd come to terms with his mortality a long time ago.
He had. I think that's his greatest speech. He really foreshadows his own death. And when he says he may not get with you to the mountaintop, but we as the people will see the promised land. And he said, like anyone, I would want a long life. Longevity has its virtue. But tonight, I'm not fearing any man. Little did he realize that a couple miles away, James Earl Ray was in his hotel room with a rifle waiting to kill him the next day. One thing people forget about King, more than Abraham Lincoln, John Kennedy, he was one of the bravest leaders in American history because they were not under constant daily threat of death. He was arrested 30 times. He was shot at. His house was firebombed. People threatened to blow up his plane. And so he faced danger every day he went outside.
Well, here's another revelation to me through your book, Chasing King's Killer. We're talking to James Swanson, and that is that the FBI itself not only had it in for him, but just before he received the Nobel Prize, he gets a letter. Describe this to us.
Yes. J. Edgar Hoover hated Martin Luther King. He thought he represented disorder. And it was announced that he'd get the Nobel Prize. And King was furious. He gave a press conference. Hoover was furious, and he gave a press conference and said, "Martin Luther King is the most notorious liar in America." And then he wrote a letter to the number 3 at the FBI, William Sullivan, head of intelligence, who said, "Great job, Edgar." And he said, "Yes, I've only gotten a few critical letters, and I share your view. The exposure of Martin Luther King is long overdue."
Exposure of what?
His private life. His
infidelity?
Yes.
Okay. So they had that on.
He was under constant FBI surveillance. In fact, they even infiltrated the movement. An African-American journalist and photographer was an FBI spy who watched King. And then a few days after that, Sullivan from the FBI wrote a vicious letter to King opposing.
This is the number three at the FBI.
Yes,
head of the Missing and Telling Sends an anonymous letter to Martin Luther King Jr.
Posing as a conservative black minister and says, we know all about you. You're depraved. You're horrible. You must commit suicide in the next 43 days before he would accept the Nobel Prize. Of course, King wouldn't kill himself.
Or will expose you on the day of the award.
Right, right. And of course, they didn't do that. This letter and these recordings were mailed to King's house, and his wife received them first.
Really?
The FBI tracked him and tried to humiliate him in every way possible. Ironically, once he was killed, President Johnson and the Attorney General ordered Hoover find the killer. And Hoover knew that if he didn't do it, the FBI would go down in infamy. So it's ironic that the man who hated King did an incredible job to track down its killer, because he knew it was the end of the FBI as he knew it, if he failed in that job.
Okay, then it wasn't so virtuous as it was self-preservation.
Yes, yes.
But what an amateur hack job to send that letter from the number three at the FBI.
Yes. The letter was lost for decades, but it was rediscovered recently in the archives. It's filled with typos, errors, and
as if to mimic what he would believe to be a less educated black person?
Or from a regular person on a typewriter at home.
Yeah. Okay. Martin Luther King is assassinated, and James Earl Ray gets away, essentially, right? For how long?
He does. He fired one shot from the bathroom of a boarding house across the street from the Lorraine Motel when Martin Luther King was standing alone on the balcony, and he hit him in the head and killed him. He runs out down the steps. He escapes under the street. He hops in his Mustang and drives away, and he's driving through Memphis, and radio broadcasts are out looking, look for the white Mustang. A teenager on CB radio thinks he's going to play a prank. So he says, I'm in pursuit of the Mustang now. It's driving this way. It's going 90 miles an hour. It's going 100 miles an hour. He's opened fire on me now. The police think it's a real radio broadcast, and so they're misdirected. And Ray drives, of all places, to Atlanta, King's hometown. He thinks that's the last place they're going to look for his killer, his hometown. He then gets on a Greyhound bus to Cincinnati, then a bus to Michigan, then a taxi to Canada. He hides out in Canada, gets a fake passport, and then flies to England because he wants to fly to Africa and join a white mercenary army where he can't be extradited back to the United States.
Had he planned all of that out, or was that him thinking on the fly?
Part of it was thinking on the fly, because he thought he had to get various paperwork to prove he was a Canadian to get the passport. He just had to say, I'm a Canadian, I need a passport. So he wasted days and days. He didn't have enough money. He later said, I wish I had more money. I should have pulled a bank job before I flew to England. I didn't have enough money to escape to Africa.
Would they have known to look for him but for the fingerprints he left behind?
No, because he used different names. Harvey Lohmeyer, Eric Starvo Galt. No one knew the name King was killed, that they were looking for a man named James Earl Ray. He left evidence behind, his fingerprints, a transistor radio with a serial number on it that tracked him to the prison where he escaped from. And so the fingerprints were key, and they had to be searched manually by hand. And ultimately, about 10 days after the assassination, the FBI discovered first that it was Ray under a false name. Then the next day, they learned it was James Earl Ray. And then they learned from Canadian authorities that he had escaped to England. And so 2 months later, when Ray was at Heathrow Airport, ready to fly to Africa, they caught him.
How so?
Stupidly. He'd sloppily written down the name on it for his passport. And he got it corrected when he flew to Lisbon, Portugal for a week to try to get to Africa. And he got a new passport from the consul. He's at Heathrow to fly away. And then he would have escaped for good. And he hands the passport. And the guy at the counter says, oh, can I see the other one? Ray foolishly was still carrying the other passport. So I thought, why does this guy have two passports? And then a guy from Scotland Yard said, oh, can I talk to you for a moment? Can I see those? And Ray was on a watch list. And this guy thought it was the killer of Martin Luther King. Oh, do you mind if we search you? Ray stupidly carried a pistol to the airport. It was illegal in London for private citizens to own unlicensed firearms. And they locked him in a room, and a few hours later they came back and said, we don't believe you're Canadian. We believe you're an American. And Ray said, well, yes, I am. And they said, we believe you're wanted for murder, and you are James Earl Ray. And Ray collapsed and gave it all up, and he was just crushed.
This was before the internet.
One evidence, I think, that shows that Ray was not part of a conspiracy. If he was part of a conspiracy, why didn't he get a conspirator's car who drove him away, and we never saw him again.
Well, he ran by after he shot Dr. King. Like, dude, put the getaway car closer and don't have a couple of squad cars in between you and it.
Yes. And he didn't have money to escape.
No.
He didn't have a great plan. No one helped him. If it was a conspiracy, it would have been better funded, better planned, and he would have disappeared.
Or he would have been in Russia. I mean, wasn't that the thought, too? No. It was wondered if maybe Martin Luther King himself was associating with the Soviets, correct?
Yes. Even the Kennedy brothers, John and Robert, thought that King had communist ties. Of course, Martin Luther King was not a communist. But Robert Kennedy was very suspicious of King. King was not allowed to come to the White House before the March on Washington in 1963, only later, once he had proved he had had a peaceful event that day. And Robert Kennedy, of course, is the man who signed the wiretap order that allowed J. Edgar Hoover to place King under surveillance.
That's interesting because we remember Bobby, too, as the one who broke to the world, or to many people, many blacks, that Dr. King had been assassinated.
Yes, he was in Indianapolis. He knew before his plane landed there that King had been shot, and when he landed, he knew he had died, and he announced it to the predominantly African-American audience, and that was one of Robert Kennedy's best speeches, probably his greatest speech of healing and reconciliation and mourning. It was really an incredible year, because first, Martin Luther King is assassinated in April. Then, 2 months later in June, Robert Kennedy is assassinated. The Tet Offensive, protests in Vietnam, civil rights protests, riots in the cities, arson when King is killed, riots in 100 cities.
Well, you pointed out, too, that Bobby had not spoken publicly, not at any length, about his brother's assassination.
No, but he mentioned it that night in Indianapolis to calm the crowd, and he said, we must not riot, we must have love in our hearts. My brother was killed by a white man, but we must get through this.
What happens to James Earl Ray when he's then captured?
James Earl Ray is brought back to America, brought back to Tennessee, where he'd be put on trial. Because, remember, at that time, it was not a federal crime to kill a president or a civil rights leader. Lee Harvey Oswald did not violate federal law by killing John Kennedy. He violated the murder laws of Texas, as James Earl Ray violated the murder laws of Tennessee. So he's put on trial. And then he got involved with a series of famous, prominent, but crazy lawyers who wanted to profit from book deals and magazine articles, and they didn't represent him well. They convinced him to plead guilty to avoid the death penalty, and later he tried to withdraw that plea, and he wasn't allowed to. He was sentenced to life in prison. James Earl Ray outlived Martin Luther King by 30 years, and he died in prison. He escaped again, but he was on the run for only 3 days.
Why is that so important to you, that he lived 30 years longer than Dr. King?
Martin Luther King was only 39 when he was killed. He was such a young man. It's conceivable that this year, for the 50th anniversary of his death, if he had lived, he would have been 89 years old. He could be alive today. And think of what he could have done to lead the civil rights movement through the rest of the 60s, the 70s, 80s, even today, to be a senior elder statesman. And it seems so unjust that the man who stopped all that got to enjoy life for the next 30 years.
Jesse Jackson was there.
Yes. You know,
and is still alive and well, and not as prominent in his movement as he once was, but Jesse is still a force, and certainly Rainbow Push is.
Yes, he was there. Andrew Young was there. Many of the leaders were there.
You know, you made me think of something earlier in a statement you made. What do you make of the sort of publicity that we give to famous shooters, be it in Florida or anywhere else in the world? I know in Europe they tend to downplay the name and profile of a killer. Here in America, we do exposés on the front page of the New York Times about who they were.
Well, I've written about three of them now. John Wilkes Booth, Lee Harvey Oswald, and now James Earl Ray. And it's very important to remember who the heroes of these stories are. They're Lincoln, Kennedy, and King. I think we shouldn't push the bad guy off stage. We should understand who they were, what their motives were, why they did it, and not celebrate them. A woman once approached me after my Lincoln book came out and said, I'm mad at you. And I said, why is that? She said, you made me love John Wilkes Booth. And I said, no, I just showed you what it was like to be in his shoes, to be the hunted, wanted man. The hero of my book is Abraham Lincoln. And the heroes of my other books are John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. I'm not interested in murder, per se. It's not my obsession. What I am interested in is moments of dramatic change in American history where everything can change overnight. And how important individuals can be to do great things in history. And how much we can lose overnight when that person goes. And so my books are really about these great heroes, their lives and what they meant and how they were taken from us.
Is the United States in the middle of some pivot right now, do you think, after the last election?
I don't know. We always tend to over-dramatize our own times. I think two of the most tumultuous moments in American history were the Civil War, when 750,000 Americans were killed fighting each other, and when a president was assassinated for the first time, when Abraham Lincoln was killed at the climax of that war. And certainly, the 1960s were a tumultuous time. We had war abroad, unrest at home, murders. Malcolm X is killed. Medgar Evers is killed. Martin Luther King is killed. Robert Kennedy is killed. 100 American cities are on fire. Compared to the time of the Civil War in the 1960s, we're hardly there.
Okay. Hooray. So that's your definition of hope for us right now, huh?
When we're in times that are tumultuous or there's political disagreement, we can tend to not put them in historical perspective.
How can you?
And if we don't know our history, the time we're in seems the most important time ever, the most divisive time ever, the most dramatic time ever. But to put current times in historical context, I think can give us some comfort and some perspective on how to evaluate the present.
I have to tell you, when I first picked up your book, I thought, all right, I'll read a juvenile book about this important story, but I'm smarter than that. I don't want to read down. And you're right, the book does not read or talk down. It absolutely elevates. I think the illustrations and the photographs are positively illuminating. I think the prose is really good. I think the editing is good, too. You had a lot to work with, and I'm sure you left some things on the table, but some of the speeches and some of the quotes I found positively illuminating. I think everybody should read this book.
Oh, thank you.
James Swanson, the book is Chasing King's Killer, The Hunt for Martin Luther King Jr.'s Assassin. It's a Scholastic Press book out now. Buy it wherever you buy books and read this thing. You can do it quickly, and you will be glad that you did.